Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, welcome to this week's episode of the Mum and Mama podcast, brought to you as always by the wonderful Golding Accountancy, wearegolding.com. How are you? I hope you are good. So this week I was at the podcast convention and did the Pod Bible live podcast from there with Rich Wilson from Insane in the Membrane podcast and Josh Weller and Alfie Brown from the Formula One podcast. I can't remember what it's bloody called now. I'll post links to everything, but Alfie was saying that he started doing a podcast to stop him from saying and things like that. And it really made me laugh because that's like, it's the hardest thing to stop doing when you're presenting, is stop making those noises. So yeah, that just reminded me of that. So, but it was really, really good. It was a lot of fun. I met some really wonderful people. I met Josh Weller and Rich Wilson, who obviously have been previous guests of mine for the first time in real life. So that was lovely. And loads of other people that I've kind of been in contact with through the podcast that I've never met. So it was a really good day, and there was loads of exciting things there if you went. I hope you had fun. This week on the podcast it's the first in three episodes with the wonderful Henry Haight. Henry Haight is a tattooist that I met probably, it was pre-children, so I reckon it's got to be getting on for about 15 years now. And he's lovely. We became friends. And he's got a very interesting life story. He's an artist as well as a tattoo artist. And he's probably most well known for... He's the one that did the tattoo of the lady on Amy Winehouse's arm. Like kind of her iconic tattoo. And he was very close friends with her as well. So I wanted him... He actually approached me about coming on the podcast to talk about how mothers influence their children in terms of art. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. And I had wanted him to come on anyway, but I was like, why don't you come on and talk about that as well as everything else? So, but he was here for 5 hours. We just had such a good catch up, but the podcast is 3 hours long essentially. So I've split it into three episodes. But this first episode is kind of about his childhood and how he first started getting interested in art, but also about how his parents sent him for conversion therapy when he first came out. There's a lot in it, and I hope you enjoy it. If you want to talk to me about anything we discuss, obviously, then please get in touch, and I'll of course post links to Henry as well in the podcast information. But yeah, enjoy, and I'll see you in a bit.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Work.
So, because I always thought that it would be a cool thing, because right now tattooing is so saturated.
Yeah.
And I know when Nicole moved out, she's now in Clapton. But a few shops around me have actually started to close.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because, you know, if food prices are going up, energy prices are going up as well, the living wage is staying the same, the cost of everything has gone up, people tend to cut back and virtually, you know...
Yeah.
Saturday, I had a conversation with a guy, and he wanted 2 tattoos on his kneecaps. You know,
yeah.
So it's just artwork, but he'll want, and I'm like, okay. He's like, smiley faces. I'm like, okay, I'll do the pair for 140.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, the guy around the corner said he'll do it for 60 quid in his basement.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking to me for then?
Yeah.
You don't know a good price.
Yeah.
Then, but, you know, you're speaking to someone who's wearing 6-pound jeans. And so,
yeah,
nothing against them, but it's just like, okay,
for me, there are certain things that you don't want to save money on. You don't want a cheap tattoo because you're not going to, you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
And that is on your body forever. You know, it's not, there's some things, it's not about finding the cheapest thing. It's about finding the best thing. And
well, I've growing up, we didn't have a lot of money, and my mom was the one who virtually bought us our clothes, and, you know, and I remember she used to complain, and I think, and I noticed it, I never noticed it when we were kids, but around the time I was about 13 or 14, when certain things like the Izod, the alligator, like, you know, I never liked polo, but I wanted these type of shoes. And I remember, I think they were, at the time, like $100. And my mom was like, that's outrageous for shoes. And I still think that now, that, you know, for certain shoes. But I think as a parent, I never looked at it from the aspect of, you know, and especially now kids with smartphones and, you know, social media. Oh, God, you know, everyone wants to be liked, loved, and be accepted.
Yeah.
And I think it's good that social media now have the thing where you can hide the likes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can post something, and then when you go to the 3 dots, it's like, if you want to hide the likes. So even you, for your own psyche, you don't need to know how many people like your photos.
Yeah.
Because that whole... dopamine effect, that seeking that validate, like, oh, it's nice to just, I stop looking at them.
Yeah.
Oh, because I hit it, edit, hide likes.
Yeah.
I'm done. And I just leave it alone.
Yeah.
You know, and I can't imagine being a kid right now.
Yeah.
And wanting that veneer on life, or that, when my friends, I think I was 22, and my friend Melissa bought her daughter a beeper, and she was 12. I'm like, well, she needs to be professional. She's not a pot dealer, you know? And I'm like, she's like, I know what she is. I'm like, well, if you never know where your kid is, if you're having to wonder where your kid is, she's doing something that she shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
You know? But now, the kids grow up in a world to where they have access to everything. So, it's I don't want to say it's more alarming, but I think it also stunts their creativity to where they're focused on phones.
Yeah.
And, or this device. Yeah. Where they're enslaved to it. And now companies have that information, the access to how to virtually prone certain things to what they're doing,
yeah,
to the device directly,
yeah,
to groom them in a sense, which, yeah, is really
fucked. You know?
So now I try to really actively turn it upside, yeah, down. Unless I'm waiting, like if I text someone to go, okay, do you want me to, and I'm like,
yeah.
You know, more than scrolling, swiping left or whatever, yeah. I want to see what's happening with that particular guy.
Yeah.
But now I think I've waned back a bit on social media posts,
yeah,
and stuff.
I go in and out of it. I have to do it for the podcast because that's the only way I really advertise. But
that's your revenue, right?
Well, not really. I don't really have much money out of it, but...
No, but it helps.
Yeah, but if you're not posting, then when you do post, it doesn't get seen as much. You have to be on there constantly, don't you, to get seen more, basically.
Right.
But I find it hard to not to make myself post, and sometimes I get a bit like I want to hide away from the world when I'm not well or I'm due on. I'm very much like I don't want to be seen, so I have no interest in going on social media, and I find it very hard to force myself to do that. But it's really hard because if I'm not on there, then when I do go back on there, it doesn't get seen as much as if I'm posting regularly. So it's a fucker, and they change their algorithms all the time. Like, some stuff I post, it gets seen by loads of people, and other times I'll post and it will get seen by hardly anyone, you know, and there's no, I don't know how that works, you know.
Well, that's what I'm learning right now with online marketing, with my website, the art ones, and the time, because I'm trying to figure it out, and then certain things I'll post that, like, this one does really well.
Yeah.
And the other ones I think would do really well, yes. And I'm like, what? Really?
Yeah.
Like, but I just like, okay, you just have to keep at it. But even with trying to make art, you have to keep at it.
Yeah.
And I think with, especially now with social media and these advertisers like, hey, learn how to draw like me. Yes, you know, it's great if you want to learn a hobby or an angle from that, but if you're really going to try to sit there and learn, like, well, if this girl can do it,
yeah,
you know, then I can. The whole reaction is, if you go to art school and your genius student says only maybe 3 or 4% of you out of the whole graduate class will actually make a living doing art,
yeah,
it's up to the actual student to say, you know what, you got to keep at it.
Yeah.
And I figured I knew enough creative people who were crazy enough to dedicate their whole lives of, like, why do you do what you do knowing that there's no guarantee?
Yeah.
You know, there's no regular paycheck.
Yeah.
Like, and I think the whole thing for me is if you take a leap of faith, life will cast you a net.
Yeah.
And when I do get money from it, there is this...
Yeah.
But at the same time, I know I'm following my heart, but I have to keep it at it like a business.
Yeah.
To say, okay, keep going, keep more work.
Would you go into teaching?
Do you want teaching?
Yeah.
No, because I think I've trained tattooist, and that was hard enough.
Yeah.
And having a staff of like 7 and then trying to encourage them to just fucking work was like pulling teeth. You know, I couldn't, you know, to get them to just mop or answer the fucking phone was, you know, a chore in itself.
Yeah.
And sometimes they'd all be standing there, and we'd be having a meeting, and, you know, and none of them would, like, go to the, and, like, and I would say this comment, oh, I'll get it, I'm just the furthest from the phone, you know, yeah, and yeah. They'd all sit there and be like, I'm like, come on, guys, fucking, yeah, work with me here.
Yeah.
And I think of how my parents used to raise me, and I didn't ever want to go into that, like, turn, especially I didn't want to turn to my mother, but I said, you have two choices. I could ask you the diplomatic way, or I could ask you the Henry Haight way. Which way would you like? And I like the diplomatic way. I'm like, okay. Like, you know, because you don't want to lose your shit over it. And there's, but trying to teach someone is in itself and encourage them to be fearless in a sense is a hard thing because you have to get them out of their comfort zone without making them feel inadequate.
Yeah.
You know, and I've trained 6 people in 28 years. And 5 of them have done it. Yeah. I don't know if they're still doing it now. But now I've noticed the lifespan of a tattooist used to be, you know, 10, 15 years. Now it's like down to 6 or 8 years.
Really?
Yeah, because now it's, you know, it's kind of like hairdressing shops. There's so many in fucking Hackney. They're like, when I saw how many rent, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And it's the price margin has come down. And now I understand why there's like 15 artists in one studio, because not all of them are always going to be busy, but you need to have a stable of trickling money to come in from each of these sons of bitches to keep your shop above float. And, you know, I've been fortunate that I've got, you know, the art side to help that, but I still have to time management, all that. When I was little, I think I was around 10 or 11, I heard the word Renaissance man. And my mom asked me, she asked me once, she's like, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be a Renaissance man. And she's like, what is that? And I said, Renaissance man is a man who makes music and paints, who, you know, writes, does all this stuff. And, you know, he creates. And she's like, you can't do everything. And I was so mad at her. I swear to God. I mean, I didn't talk to her for a month. I was really that upset.
Yeah.
One thing I learned about my parents, they can fuck hold grudges. You know? And I was just, because to me, that was like, oh no, let me just quash your dream.
Yeah.
I don't think she meant it in that way, but that was the first time I was like, you can't say that to me.
Yeah.
You know, and, but again, looking back at it, that I think she would have said, you're going to have to focus on, you can't do everything at once, but you can do all of them, but you can only do them at, you know, but she didn't say that, but that's how I heard it. You can't do everything.
Did she support you in your creativity?
She did, but it was when I started to get around 14, 15, punk happened for me, and that's when I was like, you know, the apple on my head dropped. I was like, oh my God. There are all these weirdos, they list like weird things, and I do too. And I felt like in high school, it was either the stoners, the punks, or the, you know, because like when you see American movies with its segregation of like, you know, you've got the cats and they're Asian, Oriental, nerds and stuff. Yeah, I didn't hang out with those. I didn't hang out with the black students. I knew some of the black students.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Salabat in Orange County. Yeah. And, but it was, you know, everyone sat in these tribes, and I hung out with the benchers, which were the punks, and the goss,
and
some metalheads, but we were kind of the weirdos,
and
we hung, our lockers were by the boys and girls' toilets, so we could go in there and smoke, and directly across with the quad, there was this tree planting, big plant, where all the Asian kids, I think now it would be called like Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you know. And then across from that was the student union office where they sold like library books and not library but yearbooks and stuff.
Yeah.
But that's where like some of the cheerleaders and the popular kids used to hang out. The jocks were on the opposite side. All the cooler kids never sat at, all the dorks ate at the lunch tables.
Yeah.
But my mom really encouraged our individuality. And when we started to buy our own records, I remember her looking and going, what is this? This is a true story. Remember that song, the cover of The Flying Lizard's Money? The best things in life are free.
Yeah.
When that instrumental part, my dad picked up the speaker and he was like, what's wrong with this music? And he's like shaking it. They're like, that's the way it's supposed to sound. He's like, what? And he's like, that? And I'm like, yes. He couldn't understand that, you know. And I think, again, when things culturally do a shift and someone doesn't understand it, it's funny to go, what, huh? And then, you know, when my mom got me some bondage trousers, she didn't know the S&M connotation with them.
Yeah.
But she did catch me with a Tom of Finland picture. And it was one of the first pictures that made me have a reaction like, oh my God. It started me because unlike the art that I had seen with my mom, you know, she couldn't take us to Venice, but she kind of chose us to see films. Like every Sunday when she was separated from my dad, every Sunday a ritual was she would take me and my brother to the movies without question. And we spend 4 hours at the cinema, double feature. And I had to put about 10 or she took me to go see Cruising with Al Pacino about the leather bed. And I was like, She wouldn't let me see The Exorcist, but she took me to see Al Pacino about this murdering psychopath killing leather gays in Manhattan, you know.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't want me to see Dawn of the Dead, but I could see guys getting fisted in a leather bar. And the weird thing was my parents, because I think they grew up in the sexual revolution, my dad's records were another visual to me, to art.
Yeah.
Because he had the Janis Joplin Big Brothers Cheap Thrills album done by Robert Crumb. And I got to meet Robert Crumb. And I remember as a kid, I would hold the album cover and just stare at it for hours. And he didn't like that I was indenting the sleeve with my feet because I would sit there.
Yeah.
Or Elton John's Captain Fantastic and the Joker, because those album covers were just amazing. Because to me, they were cartoons. And they were very visual. You know, no one makes album covers like that anymore.
Yeah.
But that was my window to art, and I was like, don't fuck up my albums.
Yeah.
You know, the Santana Abrazas album that was a staple for any Chicana, and I was like, the Naked Woman. I was just like, oh man. I used to look at those and go, those should be hung in the Louvre.
Yeah.
But my parents were like, don't fucking touch our records. And
what did your parents do for work?
Huh?
What did your parents do for work?
My dad was a laborer. He then started doing, he was a receiving and shipping foreman for a company that's now was now considered Fujitsu.
Okay.
And my mom used to do some, like manual labor as well. And her happiest job, she ever said, she was a sales assistant at a bridal boutique selling discount wedding dresses. She loved that job. She said that was, you know, because she just sold, you know, discount wedding dresses.
Yeah.
They never really had like executive jobs. And then when I started to be self-employed, I remember my dad saying, I don't know how you do it. I could never do what you do.
Yeah.
For, you know, it's like, it's a lot of work. And it is a lot of work. But I thought, okay, you know, they didn't encourage me in that end. I had to figure that out on my own. But I remember...
So were you always super artistic?
Huh?
Were you always artistic?
I was. And I remember my mom and dad would, if they couldn't afford art supplies, they would pinch office supplies from their cabinets at work and bring them home. And
yeah.
I remember they brought these bowls of, like, rolls of paper. And it was just like, I would have that for like 6 months, and I would just doodle, just draw on anything. And if I didn't doodle on the walls, I'd draw on the paper. If I didn't have a notepad, I'd draw on the notepad. And then if that wasn't, I'd draw my brother. And I remember she once bought us those Easter egg baskets with all the candies and stuff, and in there was like watercolors and marker pens. I never liked that she would dress us in kind of matching outfits. I'd have like a green color when my brother have a red.
Yeah.
Or we have similar, like the studded denim things. And I always wanted my own identity, where she, I think to my mom, she's like, oh, look at the two kids are dressed alike.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. And once I remember with those Easter egg baskets, my pen ran out and my brother wouldn't let me use his. So I remember grabbing one of the markers and just swiping across it. But it's just like, and we were like just stabbing each other with these markers. And we ruined our outfits. Like, we only had them on for a couple of hours. And she's like, what the fuck? And, you know, there was a sibling rivalry. And I think she really tried to make us feel loved. But I think my brother, in my own sense, I think they favored him more because he was a younger one. And to my brother, even to this day, because I had slightly more talent, he felt less than.
Yeah.
And more resentful. Because I do know for a fact that they sometimes rubbed that in his face, which was unforgivable.
Yeah. Is he arty as well?
He was, but he never really... He never really cultivated it, as well as... My brother had problems with going to school, and he was kicked out of high school.
Oh, really?
And then he went out. He was doing continuation school where they go from like 9 to like 11:30. They were out by like lunchtime.
Yeah.
And he even felt that. He just
wasn't interested.
But they coddled my brother more.
Yeah.
And I came out at 17. I knew my brother was gay before I did. But then when my mom found out, she was livid with me that I didn't tell her. And by then I was already snotty. And I was just like, are you fucking serious? She's like, don't talk to me that way. I'm your mother. I'm like, you actually think that he's going to come to you with open arms after how you treated me? Because they put me through conversion therapy.
Really?
Yeah.
How old were you when you came out?
17.
So what was that like? Oh my god!
It was really hard.
What was it? A religious thing?
They sent me to a Catholic. Yeah, they sent me to a Catholic one, and then sent me to a Christian. My mom sent me to a Christian one. My dad had no, like, when I got arrested at 13 for shoplifting, we had to go to court-appointed therapy. My dad wouldn't go. My mom went with us.
Yeah.
And it was really hard because she was virtually raising us. My dad was kind of an ass in a sense. And you know, the lines were like, I think because my dad came from a broken home.
Yeah.
He went through juvenile hall and all that. And here my parents argue. They really used to go at each other about their upbringings.
Yeah. Where did they grow up?
Grew up in Orange County. Well, my mom grew up in Arizona, and then they moved. All her sisters were born in different states.
Yeah.
But they were in North Dakota.
Okay.
When a tornado tore down their, they were sharecroppers with a neighboring family, and they both lost their homes.
Oh, wow.
So the neighboring family went to Texas, and my mom and all her sisters went to California.
Okay.
And then my aunt, by the time they went to California, the youngest, my aunt Jane was born in California, and my mom was born in Arizona, but they moved all over.
Yeah.
My dad was born in Fresno. And when my mom met my dad, I think she was 12 or 13.
Oh, wow.
And, but they always looked at my dad as less than.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed she like stuck it out with him for so long.
God, that's a long time.
With her, I have to say she was very resilient in a lot of ways, because she had like a fourth grade reading capacity. She was very difficult for her to read.
Oh wow.
So when we had applications, she'd hand me it to like, what's to say? And then explain to her. And I remember once getting really frustrated with her because, like, I would try to teach her, and she's like, I need help. And
yeah.
I didn't understand the fact that for her it was very difficult. But I can see now, looking back, how teachers then, even with me when I was going through what they thought I was colorblind, that, you know, people in those authority figures, they would just write you off.
Yeah.
You know, now, you know, some classes are smaller, or they, you know, they approach teaching for children in a more nurturing way.
Yeah.
To encourage those who think mechanically and methodically, to those that have to go through apodextrosy to touch, sight, you know, to like figure out the senses of how to do, work something out. And I believe that's, you know, those are two camps that work, that are beneficial in both ways. But back then, it was like, oh, no, this is a bad egg, not as good egg.
Yes. Yeah,
and I was always really, I never liked the fact that when I was around 12, I didn't feel that I was special, but I knew I had a gift or something. I felt different, not because of my sexuality, but I started to see things differently than other kids.
Yeah.
And then when I drew things, kids were like, oh my God. And then I knew I could make friends. I could get things out. It was a commodity that I could use to my benefit. And a teacher told me this. And I was like, and he really encouraged. And then when I showed my mom, she was like, wow, okay. You know, I did the acting and singing things because I could just, those things came natural to me.
Yeah.
Whereas math didn't.
Yeah.
You know, I liked science. I liked to know how things were made.
Yeah.
And even in films, but I was really a bad student in the technical aspect, the methodical of like, okay, read, write, subtract and stuff. You know, if they said, okay, use your mention, then I flourished.
Yeah.
I could do that. But when, around 13, 14, and I remember I wanted to see Tommy.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, that movie's about drugs. But that was what she said to me. But I remember my dad taking me to a drive-in movie to see Fritz the Cat, about a hypersex cat having sex with a bunch of prostitutes and cheating on his, you know, and her covering my eyes, and he wanted to see this cartoon of like a tripping out cat.
Yeah.
By Robert Crumb, who did the Janis Joplin thing. So, you know, that was what my parents were kind of into.
Yeah.
So I didn't know it at the time, but I think subculturally, that's the era. And when they started to see that I could go somewhere else, they did like it. But at the same time, I think they were fearful that once it got bigger than them, they couldn't control it. That would virtually take me into a different trajectory away from them.
Yeah.
Which I think all parents fear that, you know, oh my God, they're going to leave.
Yeah.
And
they're
going to become their own person.
Yeah.
Whereas my brother, they kept him under their thumb.
Yeah.
But that affected my brother in a different way than I did. Because, unfortunately, I hate to think that he's bitter. Because some of his friends, Fritzy, got to become their own persons earlier in life than he did.
Yeah.
But they wanted him closer because I left at 17. When I was 17, I just left.
Was that because of the conversion therapy, though?
Yeah.
Yeah. What? So what happened? What did they do or try and do? How does conversion therapy...
My mom, when I came out to my parents, I ran away from home, and I came back because I ran out of money and like everything. I basically told them, I'm like, I'm gay.
Yeah.
And my mom's like, you're not gay, and she was really angry, really really angry with me. And I remember it was like a Monday or Tuesday. Around dinner time, she's like, there's someone here to see you. I need to come downstairs. So I came downstairs, and there was this guy and this woman sitting at our kitchen table. And the guy's like, hi, I'm so-and-so from this church. And I'm like, uh-huh. He's like, so you don't want to be gay anymore? And I'm like, excuse me, what? He's like, I used to be just like you. And I'm like, what? And he's like, oh, and I was like, what is this? And my mom's like, I want you to sit and talk to him. And she's like, and she basically said, you're sick. And I was like, I was so, and again, my dad was nowhere to be seen because he wasn't there.
Yeah.
And he was talking with his wife that he used to be gay. And I'm still thinking to myself to this day, yeah, fucking right. But he was talking about, you know, the Lord this, the Lord that. That didn't work. So then she sent me to a Christian priest. And I went every week on a Thursday and a Wednesday to see him. And it was at Huntington Beach. And we would talk. And I hadn't had sex with a man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I hadn't had sex with a man that during that year. I wasn't having sex with him. Yeah. I'd had sex with men.
Yeah.
But I wasn't active.
Yeah.
And I remember him saying stuff about how he perceived gay men. Like, gay men drop coins in your hand. They need to touch you. And not, even to this day, when someone, even if it's a woman, if she drops the change in my hand at a cash receipt, at a register,
yeah,
I think of this guy.
Yeah.
I never forgot that. And I was like, holy shit. And then I saw him, I was 18, at a gay bar. And I was like...
Of course you did.
Motherfucker.
Yeah.
Did that
make you feel bad?
It made me feel bad because it made me feel that there was something wrong with me. But I knew in my heart that there wasn't anything wrong with me.
Yeah.
And I also believe that my parents grew up to believe that being gay or different was bad.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah.
I don't have to accept it, and, you know, I understood it, but when my mom... I think my mom was fearful, and at the time, this was the mid-80s when it just AIDS was coming up.
Yeah.
And... I knew she had gay friends. I'd seen them. One of them did her hair. He lived across the street from us. And, you know, she was fine with them. But for some reason, she couldn't be fine with me.
Yeah.
And...
Do you think it came from a fear of you being hurt?
Yeah, I think that. And there's this really famous saying by Carl Jung that... The biggest burden a child could have is the unlived life of its parent.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And I do think that my parents have missed out on a lot of... Because I've always thought they were really... Especially my mom, she could draw. She was... When she made us costumes, my favorite costume ever, I was 10, and she goes, what do you want to be for Halloween? My brother wanted to be like Luke Skywalker, and I wanted to be Ace Frehley of KISS, the spaceman. Yeah. And god damn it, she made me the best fucking space outfit. I had the padded cross thing, you know, silver, the platform. I fucking, I didn't want to take that costume off for weeks. I was just like, and I went to school, full kiss makeup, silver paint. I was like, fuck yeah. It got me the guitar. And I was like, I fucking roll. I was pissed, you know, I lost the but I didn't care. I had already won. I was Ace Frehley.
Yeah.
The year before, she dressed me as Charlton Heston from the Ten Commandments, and I looked like those miniature old men with the fucking walking stick. And she took me to the thrift store, the charity shop, and I had these fucking ugly sandals with actual tire treads. That was awful. But I looked like the real thing. Yeah. You know, I had the beard, everything. And people were like, wow, you look so... she was fucking good at...
Yeah.
She had an eye for detail. I was like, I don't understand why she doesn't do this for a job.
Yeah.
I could never... Because it came so natural to her.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, the whole thing back to Carl Jung, that a lot of parents sacrifice things for their kids in the sense that they go without, but at the same time, I think they really want to put that pressure on their kids to excel.
Yeah.
But then when they do understand that the kids can excel, there is going to be a disconnect.
Yeah.
At some point in that journey.
Yeah.
That they become fearful of.
Yeah.
And I think that's where you get you start to lock horns.
Yeah.
When I started to go to art school and stuff.
So is that what you went to art school after?
Yeah.
Was that college?
Yeah, college.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Where did you go?
They could see it. And I don't think they understood it. But then I started to, unlike the punk scene, I started to understand the business and different tastes in people. And what do I want to say in the world, and how do I make a footprint for myself?
Yeah.
My parents can help me.
What did you study in art? Did you have to pick? Did you draw?
I started as an illustration first.
Okay.
And this was before, you know, Photoshop. So now they teach illustration and Photoshop to illustrators. So everything is done on a computer.
Really?
Back then, you had to learn by hand.
Yeah.
You know, cut and paste, and my cut, it's awful. I was like, I cut and paste like I cook. I'm like the Swedish chef. Fucking things will get, I was like, glue on the walls, doesn't fucking matter, you know. And I'm still that way. I'm just like, you know, paint splatters, but I think my Catholic and religious upbringing and my struggles with the church, as well as their opinions of my identity sexually, of who I was, has reflected in my work. When my mom started to tell me about sex, even after I was gay, I never forgot a discussion where she said, my dad was very crude about talking this about sex. He just virtually opened a sex mag and pointed this out. Whereas my mom, she always spoke very visually. And she said, sex is like a candy bar. She's like, you can eat it by yourself, or you can share it with someone else. She's like, it comes in many flavors. Someone's going to hand you a candy bar, and you're going to like the taste. And she's like, and when you finish it, you're probably going to want another one. And she's like, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. She's but if you eat too much candy, you can make yourself sick.
Yeah.
And she's like, it comes in different wrappers, different colors.
I like that.
And she's like, but you know, you have to make sure. Like, sometimes candy will be stale. I never forgot that.
Yeah.
But she, I think she wanted to be a progressive parent, but she struggled with her own shortcomings, as well as her own, I don't want to say inadequacies, but her own fears and phobias of that.
Yeah.
Of having a gay kid, especially two gay kids.
Yeah.
And that she was never going to become a grandparent.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think Not that I didn't want to.
Yeah.
Cheat her out of that, but growing up, I saw my cousins have kids, and then I would hear my aunts talk, you know, about how unhappy their kids were with. I think two of my cousins are still married, and yeah. have, like, you know, everyone else is.
Yeah.
One of my cousins, she has three kids by three different men.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, you know, okay, you know.
You might never have had kids.
Huh?
You might never have had kids. You might have
had kids. It's not that I never wanted kids, but I didn't feel that that was the end-all, be-all. For me, I thought my parents did never really travel, they never saw the world, I really wanted to do that because I always knew that there was something bigger than, you know, 100 miles from our home.
Yeah.
And
where did you go on holiday?
Huh?
Did you go on holiday?
We went, my parents wanted to take us to Death Valley. You know, we went to Disneyland and stuff like that because we were like, you know, Knott's Berry Farm. You know, they took us once to Hawaii.
Wow.
But that was to see my aunt because her husband was, a Marine, and so they were stationed in Hawaii.
Okay. Have they left America, your parents?
Huh?
Have they left America?
No. Yes. They came to see me when I was 34.
Okay.
In London. So, and all my dad wanted to do was hang out the fucking, the embassy restaurant near Trafalgar Square, because they serve Lone Star beer. You know, the Lone Star beer on... young Sheldon.
Yeah.
He was so happy that he found a place. I'm like, you don't want to see the fucking, you know, Tower Bridge.
Yeah.
You know, Big Ben. He's like, no, I'm just happy to sit. And like, really, you just want to sit in this fucking American themed restaurant in London and drink this shitty beer. And that was my dad.
Yeah.
And my mom was like, well, he's happy. And I'm like, oh, God. Like, you know, I took him to see, the Tower of London. They got to see the crown jewels.
Yeah.
And stuff. But again, I think it's, my parents always had really simple tastes in a lot of ways. And
I'm envious of that sometimes, simple life, just to be really happy with not much.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think so. And for me, I think this goes back to when I was about 13, 14, when I realized what punk was, and, you know, there was music coming from England, and then I saw The Face in ID magazine, and, you know, I thought, my God, like, London must be paved with fucking style.
Yeah.
And I was amazed, and little did I know that, you know, later on I'd get to meet some of these people face to face, and, you know, It really had an impact on me to, like, this Anglophile, because all the music that I loved back then were essentially coming from England.
Yeah.
And, you dressed it a different way, and you looked it, but you kind of said, I'm not going to be part of the establishment. And I really relished that to go and find a different tribe. And when my mom took us shopping, for her, that also was, you know, financially suitable to her needs. Because we get old workman's shop, you know, shirts from gas stations and, like, tear them up and stencil them and put safety pin. So, yeah. We could get T-shirts or shirts for, like, you know, $2. But then it was very much DIY. Now, you know, young punk kids, they want to go to the mall and go to Hot Topic. And I can't be anything further anti-establishment than going to a mall. But, you know, then I think that was the art of craft. You kind of had a hand in your own identity. And this is before social media, but, you know, you went by what bands you liked and what you saw on record covers and music videos. And that was... that was really fun, and I liked that. And she was really, encourage that, because she thought, okay, they're just they're finding their creativity.
Yeah.
And
that's lovely.
She gave me a camera and I took it everywhere, and I just took photos. I took photos at gigs. I took photos of my friends drinking, smoking, and the funny thing was, I remember once she caught me and my brother tripping on acid, and we were jumping on our beds, and we're like, and it had to be about 3 a.m, and she poured open the door, and she's like, "Are you guys on cocaine?" And we were both laughing. She's like, "What's so funny?" And I'm like, "We're 14, we can't afford cocaine." And she was just like, "What?" And I'm like, "No, we can't afford this."
Yeah.
And but she always thought we were on cocaine. And I still think of Little Whore House in Texas when Dom DeLuise opens. He's like, "They're smoking cocaine," you know. And my parents smoked pot, and we used to pinch pot from them.
Yeah.
But my mom wasn't like a heavy drinker or anything. And as I got older, I think I dug my heels in, only because I used to hear how sad they were that I think they wanted to rebel, but they conformed to what my grandparents wanted for them.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, I'm going to do the opposite so I could not only make myself happy, but just, okay, if I fail at it, I'm going to find out on my own, but yeah. I'm really going to go at it. And I think that's what our inner turmoil was for, yeah. Like creatively, because when I saw actual art, my mom would take us to Movieland Wax Museum, which was not far from Knott's Berry Farm, and it was this place where you could see the waxworks, like Madame Tussauds.
Yeah,
and they had all the movie stars, and I loved that. But they had this one section where they had all the reproduction of the masterpieces, like Statue of David. And the very first painting I saw that made me go, oh, ever, I had to have been about 6. It was a Michelangelo Lead in the Swan, where she's, straddling the swan.
Yeah.
And stroking its neck, very phallic-like. And I remember I knew the way to get to that painting.
Yeah.
And we went maybe twice a year for the longest time.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the gift shop. It was seeing Statue of David looking, you know, up and just... And I, to this day, looking up at a man's physique, like, from that angle, it's just like, ah. but the Lead in the Swan one, more than anything, that was the first painting I remember thinking, this is a dirty picture.
Yeah.
And I love it. I didn't think of it as sex. I knew it was a bad, nasty picture, but there was something that really moved me about that image, and I didn't know how it was made. But then when they gave me crayons and the stereograph where you make the spirals, I could, like, or an Etch-a-Sketch, I was just there. Video games, no. But then when music came about, I started to put a visual with the bands and the records to the sound.
Yeah.
And then 14, I started to get into Andy Warhol, The Velvet Underground, and reading about Edie Sedgwick and The Factory. And it was coinciding with punk, where I started to see this subculture. And that started to jar my mom, because I think that's where I started to learn about hallucinogenics.
Yeah.
And, you know, pot. And I had already started to smoke pot. And I started, like, getting into the esoteric. It wasn't one thing to, like Casper the Friendly Ghost or read about UFOs, but to really understand these things that my mom had no control over, or my dad. But my dad really didn't have... I do wonder if he had a more active hand in concern, how that would have shaped me, but he just didn't really care.
Yeah.
In a sense. I know, and I'm not saying that to rub salt into his wounds, but it just, he didn't have that. My mom was really worried about those things.
Yeah.
And we saw a film called Suburbia, and there was a scene where, when we started going to gigs around 15, there's a scene where a girl is wearing this tutu and the skinhead walks up to her and he says, I'd really like to fuck your brains out. And she's like, oh, you would you? He's like, yeah, you wouldn't. It don't look like you have any. And all the guys in the pit grab pieces and rip her clothes off while she's at the show. And she's standing there buck naked. And, you know, they're all doing the mosh pit.
Yeah.
And she's like, scream. And my mom saw this and thought they'd really do that. Like, you know, beat on each other and rip each other's clothes off. And she's like, is that what happens at these things? And we're kind of like, kind of, not to that extreme, but
yeah.
And she took that as gospel. At 17, I started to have sex with a guy in an S&M form. And I remember I had a bite mark on my shoulder. And she's like, what happened to you? And I'm like, oh, I got it in a mosh pit. A friend just bought me. Joking. I'm not going to say, oh, I stole your car and rolled it down the street to have sex with a guy that lives in Tustin. And, you know, and I was a fucking bad kid. But it was just like...
Hi. So, yes, that's the wonderful Henry. So you've got a lot more to look forward to as well. I love finding out about people's lives, and people have such interesting lives, especially when they come from completely different places to you and have different experiences. I love it. I live for it. But yeah, I hope you enjoy it. If there's anything you want to talk to me about, get in touch. Follow me on the socials, Mum and Mama Pod. Mum and Mama Pod. If you have any guest suggestions, then let me know. I'm interested in talking to everyone. Everyone has a story.
Work.
I hope you're well. Stay safe, stay sane. Big love. And I look forward to seeing you next week for part 2. Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.